to wait on the subway coming down from the west side, and I just usually have everything set up.
It's interesting to see you set it up, and I'm impressed that you engineer as well as...
Well, we're not really set up too well to have to work out of... We should have what we call a combo operation where the control board is right here, mm-hmm. but it's... We still have 1 foot back in the old days when we had 44 technicians running all the studios, mm-hmm. And today where we don't.
Interesting.
So we still have old equipment. Well, I think we ought to discuss Carl Sandburg in two parts, one part being your interest in Sandburg and how you were able to pull off this wonderful biography, and the second part about Sandburg himself. Let's start with Sandburg. Why don't we start with him? When I was in grade school, in our textbooks, we read Frost and Sandburg and Masters. I don't know what they're teaching today. Perhaps they're not teaching these prairie poets. I don't know. So there may be a generation of people who don't know who Carl Sandburg was. So why don't we start with that? Who was Carl Sandburg?
Carl Sandburg was a complex man, a man of many voices. His one of his favorite photographs of himself was made by his brother-in-law, the great photographer Edward Steichen. It's a montage, six profiles of Sandburg. I think that kind of multiplicity is descriptive of him. He was, first of all, I think, a deeply involved American citizen. He was the child of Swedish immigrants. He wanted, from the beginning of his life, to be thoroughly, unconditionally American, even changed his name to Americanize it. Did that when he was in the first grade. He thought Charles was far more American than Carl, so he renamed himself. He had a deep need to articulate his vision of this American dream, which had drawn his parents to this country and this time in particular. So he began with a message, and then he adapted the mode to the message. Sometimes he articulated his message in poetry, sometimes in oratory, sometimes in journalism, later on in biography and fiction, in fairy tales for children. Then he loved the media. He discovered radio and later on television. So this man of many voices explored a message which had a coherent theme, lived in the center of his times, managed to live a stable, harmonious, reasonably harmonious family life at the same time that he sustained a highly visible career. Poet, elder statesman later on. Although, ironically, a man who died unknown to himself in many ways.
Really? Why do you say that?
He kept, as I think many of us do, he kept close to his bedside books that spoke to him at particular times in his life. And in those last 2 years, he turned to an essay by Bacon entitled On Great Fame. And he marked a line that said... That had to do with the irony of a man of great fame, apparently known to many others, dying unknown to himself. There was this lifelong excavation of self. There are 10 men in me, he said as a young man, and I don't know or understand any one of them. So in many ways, there was this subtext throughout his life of self-discovery. And when he was 87 years old, he still wasn't quite sure who Carl Sandburg was.
I'm not sure that's too unique, though. I think we all wonder why we do certain things and what kind of people are inside of us that we didn't recognize.
I think so. I think if we're truly alive, fully alive and awake, as Sandburg would say, if we're not dead from the neck up, I think that we should have this continual excavation of self, this continual exploration and you hope concomitantly this continual revelation and discovery.
Of course, Sandburg was a poet, so he could articulate these things better than most of us. Well, as a young man, he hit the road, didn't he? Had some adventures, was put in jail. Tell me about that.
He did. He loved the road. He loved the railroad in particular. He loved any highway to any unknown horizon. The love of travel started when he was quite young. He hoboed his way west to work in the Kansas wheat harvest. This is now during the Long Depression of the 1890s. He had a romantic sense of adventure coupled with a pragmatic need to get ahead. Felt very limited in his hometown. He was a hobo in the tradition of Jack London. He also, like London, got himself arrested in Sandberg's case for illegally riding the broads, hopping a freight train without a ticket. Spent a little time in the Allegheny Jail in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Made three very definite distinctions about hoboing. These distinctions were not original with him. He said they're hobos and they're bums and they're tramps. And a tramp works his way around the country, but he tramps. He never works. A bum never travels and he never works. A hobo travels, but he works. And Sandberg put himself emphatically in that third category and worked his way around the country. Later on, he hoboed with a little more dignity, I suppose, but always he was collecting the American experience. He was listening to the songs people sang. He was listening to the jokes they told in diners. He was listening to their proverbs and their sayings. He was listening to their shared experience. He was recording instinctively in notebooks which accompanied him everywhere he went, the words that he was hearing. He was eavesdropping on the American experience.
And some of your readers might be surprised to learn that Sandberg was a war veteran.
Indeed. Spanish-American War. Volunteered 1898, even enlarged his age a bit so he could be sure that he was going to be in the Army, and he made a short expedition into Puerto Rico, wrote about his experience again in those pocket notebooks, and later on in poetry and an autobiography. And war poetry permeated all of the collections of his poems during his lifetime.
And a door-to-door salesman.
Indeed, he sold stereopticon viewers and pictures. I wouldn't have understood the impact of this, I think, had I not lived for a decade in the Midwest. I'm a Southerner, and I was transplanted for a time to Indiana, to the heartland, which was Sandberg's country. He was next door in Illinois. The work as an itinerant salesman, selling those views of the world, those pictures of the pyramids and of Chicago and of oceans and of distant cultures were enormously vivid and important in the 19th century prairie heartland. This was a literal act of an ambassador, I suppose, bringing the world to the isolation of prairie farms and prairie villages. Sandberg then began his own fascination with the visual arts.
And at that time he started actually publishing poetry, I guess, in small private editions.
His college professor brought out his first collection of poetry, and it was not very good poetry. His professor, Philip Green Wright, set up a little printing press in the basement of his home in Galesburg, Illinois. And on that printing press produced Carl Sandburg's first book. He was still Charles A. Sandberg, however, and he was very critical of that early work. He didn't choose to reprint it later on, but that was the that basement in Galesburg
what
launched.
What did that
a
book
poem.
Look like?
It's a small pamphlet with a rather amateurish decoration on the cover, done, I think, as I recall, by Professor Wright's wife. His Professor Wright's son helped with the whole publication. These small pamphlets, and there were four of them at the beginning of his career, are almost impossible to find these days, immensely valuable. I would hope that anyone who happens to come across in reckless ecstasy or incidentals or Plaint of a Rose or Giuseppe would let you and me know immediately. I've been searching for years for these early pamphlets. Yeah.
Well, he left Delaware and New Jersey, went back to the Midwest, and became deeply involved in social democratic politics. Tell me about that. I guess social democratic would be correct, right?
That was
the name of the party?
That was the name of the party, yes. The Social Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Sandburg had witnessed his father's long struggle against the realities of the 19th century economy. His father was one of millions of people caught up in the Industrial Revolution. Sandburg was an instinctive populist and later an instinctive socialist. He knew very little about organized socialism. He had read very little of the socialist literature. But he was passionately concerned about the hardship of his father's life, and he extrapolated from that a wide empathy with the American working people, men, women, children. He found in the rather conservative Social Democratic Party of Wisconsin a podium for this idealism. He was the first organizer to go out into rural Wisconsin on behalf of the Social Democratic Party. He spoke to farmers in the field and factory workers in small towns, again carrying the message of his hopes for this country. He hoped that women would be able to vote. He hoped that children would not have to work in factories 6 days a week for 12-hour days. He wanted free public education. He wanted disability insurance and old age insurance and health insurance. So he was advocating some, in his mind, practical, essential reforms. He campaigned for Eugene Debs. He was with Debs on the Red Special. And he worked with Victor Berger and Emil Seidel, who became the first socialist mayor. Sandburg was his first political appointment, in fact, his own private clerk and secretary.
During this period, Sandburg met the woman who became his wife, the sister of the photographer, Steichen. Eventually, Sandburg sired three daughters, moved to Chicago, became a newspaperman. That was his basic income, and it was in Chicago during that period that he became successful with regard to his poetry. Now, tell me a little bit about this phase of his life.
Coming to Chicago was catalytic for Sandburg. It was a turning point in his life. He, at the time, was profoundly discouraged about the poetry he had been trying to learn to write now for over a decade. He discovered the Great Fellowship of Chicago Journalists. He covered the city. He was a first-hand witness to all of the conflict of Chicago life, mob violence, racial strife, the aftermath of some of the attempted reforms in the among the labor groups. He discovered Poetry Magazine, an innovative little magazine launched by a woman named Harriet Monroe, who had received his poetry, looked at it with some skepticism and even some alarm, but nevertheless had deemed it worthy of publication in her little journal, which had validated the work of so many other writers. Sandburg found himself and his voice and his subject matter in Chicago. There was a wonderful chemistry there. He had, after all, lived in Milwaukee, but he didn't have the same connection to Milwaukee. Milwaukee was the city of his political being. Chicago was the city where the poet and the journalist were at home, and where
Milwaukee's shoulders weren't quite as big.
And they weren't quite as big as this big-shouldered city, Chicago.
Well, that's where he found fame, though. His first. Mm-hmm. Major book dealt, I think, the Chicago poems, right?
Chicago Poems, first book of poetry to be published by a trade house, followed quickly by Cornhuskers and Smoke and Steel, so that by 1920 his reputation had been established. He was nationally visible as a poet and regionally visible as a journalist, becoming more engaged in his journalism. He published in 1919 a book called The Chicago Race Riots of 1919, a collection of investigative articles he had written actually before the race riots in Chicago, advocating some solutions which again to him seemed reasonable and practical, essentially the platform of the NAACP. So that by 1920 he was nationally known as a journalist as well as a poet. He won the significant poetry awards of that period.
He was really among the Ben Hecht group of hard-bitten reporters. Although I didn't get the impression Sandberg himself was quite hard-bitten. He seemed to be somewhat more genteel than Hecht and Charles MacArthur and the others.
He was perhaps a little more lyrical and mystical. I think those are the words that his editor, Henry Justin Smith, used to describe him, as apart from his colleague, Ben Hecht. That was a fortunate company, an interesting group of journalists associated with the Chicago Daily News. Smith was their managing editor, and he allowed all of his writers a freedom, which I would think would be uncommon, certainly was uncommon then, and I would suspect even more so now, in terms of the expression of other forms of writing. Sandberg was working on poetry at the same time he was doing editorials, doing again the legwork for some investigative reporting, later on doing film reviews for the Chicago Daily News.
He did film reviews for something like, I believe you said, something like 13 years, didn't he?
7 years of concentrated reviews. He filled in for a vacationing critic, liked the work, and when the critic moved on to another newspaper, Sandberg took over the job full-time. He, again, this fascination with the visual image, which had begun back in the days of his traipsing through Illinois with those stereopticon slides, he, I think, incorporated into his imagination much of the vocabulary of the motion pictures he was seeing, much of the imagery. He was intrigued with movie personalities, Charlie Chaplin, among others, traveled out to Hollywood to interview them, enjoyed doing that, discovered in the process of doing that a whole new terrain for his poetry. He discovered the Southwest and the West and began to write about that in a volume of poetry called Slabs of the Sunburnt West.
Sandberg was with the same publisher for almost his entire career, wasn't he?
He was. Alfred Harcourt helped to bring the Chicago Poems into existence. He was then working for Henry Holt. Harcourt left in 1919 to form his own firm, which was then called Harcourt, Brace, and Howe. Sandberg had to make a decision, decided to go with Harcourt and to entrust his literary fortunes to him. It was a shrewd decision and mutually beneficial. Harcourt believed in Sandberg's work. He published him for the rest of his own lifetime, and Sandberg stayed with Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. Then after Alfred Harcourt's death, Harcourt was a great promoter, too, and he was innovative in bringing Sandberg's work to the American people. He knew that Sandberg could sing those American folk songs. Had the idea then in the early days of the phonograph of bringing out records to accompany the Abraham Lincoln biography. He was one of the first multimedia men, I think, in American publishing, and it was a fortunate association.
That was my next question, because at some point Sandberg began to get the idea of writing a biography of Lincoln. How did that come about?
Sandberg had three little girls. He began telling them stories, those stories evolved into children's books called the Rutabaga Stories, Rutabaga Pigeons, and Rutabaga Country. Harcourt published those books, and he and Sandberg were amazed to see that those books of children's fiction were more lucrative than those earlier books of poetry. Because the children's books had done so well, Sandberg and Harcourt began to talk about a juvenile biography of Abraham Lincoln. Sandberg had always felt Lincoln's presence. He grew up in the shadow of Abraham Lincoln. So he began to work on this biography of Lincoln for young people. And within about 6 months' time, that book had expanded, so it was clear to Sandberg and Harcourt that it was going to become a full-fledged biography for the general audience. Indeed, it grew, and it grew, so that by 1926, there were the two volumes of Abraham Lincoln, The Prairie Years, and in 1939, four more volumes, Abraham Lincoln, The War Years. So those children's stories gave birth to the multi-volume Lincoln biography.
In some respects, the Lincoln biography was controversial because it didn't quite meet the standards of an academic biography. Tell me about that.
Sandberg was unorthodox in every avenue of his work. He was not writing history. He was not writing straightforward biography when he was writing Lincoln. He did not include the conventional apparatus. There were no footnotes. He departed from so many of the traditions and expectations of biography. But he was very precise about the mission he had undertaken. He was giving us, he said, a certain portrait of Abraham Lincoln. He was giving us, in essence, the higher, what he perceived as the higher truth, the higher reality of Lincoln as a national symbol. These were the days after World War I. We were searching for a national identity. Sandberg saw Lincoln as the metaphor, the symbol, the figure who could give us a cohesion of national vision. So he was dealing, quite frankly, with a certain element of mythology, although some critics saw his Lincoln as one of the more human portraits to be drawn by that time. Sandberg's journey into Lincoln was an exploration of the American experience, an exploration of American history, in hopes of giving some synthesis to the very difficult present in which the nation was involved, and in making some statement about his own hope for our national future.
It was also a major economic turnaround, too. I had the impression that he had a rather hand-to-mouth existence during the Depression. You pointed out that his $75 a week salary at the Chicago Daily News was cut in half, but the Lincoln biography really produced a substantial income for him, didn't it?
It did. It was a time of enormous personal struggle. The financial struggle had been continuous from the beginning of his life. Two of his daughters were handicapped, two of these children for whom he had begun to invent the Rutabaga stories. Money was an overriding concern, a driving concern, because he knew early on that he was going to have to leave an estate which would care for these daughters well past his own lifetime, and they are still living 24 years after his death, thriving because of the foresight that he and his wife invested in their care, so that the financial imperative had these deep personal overtones. Harcourt, again, innovator that he was, had the idea of proposing a serial sale for this nonfiction work. Earlier, Lincoln biographies had been serialized, but Harcourt was able to sell the serial rights to the Lincoln for a staggering price, over $20,000. That was a lot of money in 1926. And this secured the well-being of the those Sandburg children. Sandburg was astonished for the first time he and his wife could begin to think about such luxuries as actually buying some of the books he needed for his research instead of having to borrow them for friends.
Now, at some point, Sandburg picked up a guitar.
He learned to play the guitar not very well early on. He only knew three chords, we're told, although late in his life, Andres Segovia tried without success to broaden his range and called him one of the most inept students of the guitar he'd ever known. That didn't interfere at all in their friendship. Sandburg loved to sing. Back in those hobo days, he had begun to collect American folk songs and transcribe them with his own very simple notation system, and he'd write down the words, and he began to sing. And in 1920, he discovered, as he was out lecturing in colleges and to civic clubs, reciting his poetry, that these audiences were very responsive when he picked up the guitar and sang a few folk songs. He became a superb platform entertainer. And I found in my research through the Midwest that many people know him there primarily as the troubadour poet. They heard him sing those songs, and they heard him read that poetry. They heard him talk about Abraham Lincoln. And they heard him expounding on the American scene. The folk music drew him to a very significant work, the American Songbag, one of the first anthologies of American folk music. Sandburg worked with musicologists such as John Lomax and gave us the first transcriptions of some of the songs that our ancestors had been singing since the mid-19th century.
At some point, Sandburg left his native Midwest and moved south. How did that happen? How did that come about?
In 1945, he and his family moved to my home state, North Carolina. They moved from the Midwest to the South for the fundamental reason that I think attracts Midwesterners to that area of the country these days. They simply needed a more temperate climate. Sandburg's health problems required that. Mrs. Sandburg, extraordinary woman, all on her own, was a scientist, a geneticist, and she had begun to breed champion dairy goats. Those goats had to be barn-fed up there on the dunes of Lake Michigan in the winter, so she needed gentler winters. She needed wider grazing meadows for the goats. So that all of those reasons drew them to that part of the country. It was, in a sense, a retirement, although Sandburg was immensely productive there. He was entering now his celebrity years, beginning to enjoy the role of the elder statesman. So he lived out his life in Flat Rock, North Carolina, in an antebellum house built by Christopher Memminger, who was the first Secretary of the Treasury for the Confederacy. Sandburg mused on the irony of the Lincoln biographer and the former socialist wending his way south and living in this house built by a Confederate official overlooking 245 acres of the most beautiful mountain and meadowland you'll ever see. And that house is today a national park site.
And that's where Sandburg died.
He died there in 1967.
He was 80?
89 years old.
Wow. At some point, you found your way to Flat Rock and became interested in Sandburg. What happened?
I went to Flat Rock simply to see the house shortly after it had opened to the public as a National Historic Site. I had no particular regard for Sandburg, knew very little about him. I was immersed in 19th century American literature. I knew about, three Sandburg poems, and I knew vaguely of the Lincoln biography. But I went, as I say in the preface to the book, reluctantly to Sandburg, and I even literally went reluctantly to that house. When you see the house, you are overwhelmed by the presence of this writer's work. There are more than 10,000 books. most of them studded with book markers, his handwriting visible on those. There were, at that time, more than 30,000 letters and manuscript pages of research value. So the house was strewn with papers and books. I thought it would be fascinating to get my hands on those books and papers. I wanted to see. My curiosity was aroused. I thought this would be a wonderful opportunity to work with the papers of this American literary figure.
You volunteered to be a curator?
I volunteered to do that. The National Park Service was at work securing the physical property and had not yet become involved with the papers. Volunteered. We spent a good bit of time in the summer in that part of the country. I combed that house. It took several summers to do that, retrieving from the attic and from the cellar and from under the beds and in the file cabinets and in the boxes stowed away in some of the dependencies.
This was purely a volunteer effort?
This, at the beginning, was a volunteer effort. And at the beginning, we had no idea about the scope of the papers. Mrs. Sandberg had sold the house to the Department of the Interior. The University of Illinois Library is the repository for Sandberg's papers, and they had removed, by actual bill of lading, 4.5 tons of books and papers from Connemara over the years. No one, the university, the Sandberg family, the National Park Service staff, no one then knew the scope of the material which had been left in that house. You must picture a house of 22 rooms, several outbuildings full of books and papers. So that my first summer of volunteer work was simply the beginning of a long search and retrieval operation. There were unpublished manuscripts. There were thousands upon thousands of letters of significance there. The papers were eventually removed to the University of Illinois Library, and it took me until 1984, working with the University and the National Park Service, to organize those papers.
Well, at some point, you must have gotten the idea that it was, there has to be a book in this.
I began to see that. And when I started 14 years ago working on Sandberg, I had no vision of a book. I simply began with the papers. The papers led me to key individuals, and I began to interview people who had known Sandberg. As a particular file on a particular individual would grow and expand over the years of my work in the organization of the papers, I would then seek out that individual. After I had organized those more than 30,000 papers and interviewed 150 people, I said, someone needs to write a comprehensive biography of Sandberg. There were earlier biographies, but until I finished this work of organization, these materials were not available. So that any biography written before 1984 had to be done without access to all of these significant materials. When I realized the need for a biography, I began to look about. No one was at work on a biography of Sandberg or any other significant study of Sandberg. And gradually I began to think of doing it myself.
And it was a process that took quite a number of years.
The work on the book has taken 7 years. I started working with Sandberg 14 years ago, thought about doing the book about 8 years ago, began to write in earnest 6 years ago.
Well, it must be an eerie feeling to have one person in your life all of those years. You must go to bed thinking about Sandberg, waking up thinking about Sandberg. When you have lunch, you think about Sandberg.
My daughter has captured that experience. She has lived half of her life now with Carl Sandberg. Along about eighth grade, on the first day of school, her teacher asked her and all of her classmates to introduce themselves and to indicate the professions of parents. And my daughter Jennifer said, my father is a college administrator, and my mother is obsessed with this dead guy. And that obsession translated itself into this book. It's been fascinating. I haven't been bored ever for a moment. I could have gone on, I suspect, for additional years, but I learned a lot about writing biography from reading Sandberg on biography, and he pointed out that you have to know when to bring closure to the work.
It should be pointed out, too, that you have a academically approved biography as opposed to the Lincoln biographies of Carl Sandburg.
Well,
with
did,
footnotes.
I did live for a while in what I thought of as footnote purgatory as I was triple-checking all of those facts. One complex facet of this work is that Sandburg lived 89 years in the center of American life. He believed that a poet should address the living issues of his time, and he was very deeply involved as a citizen in this country, as well as a writer and an observer. This meant that because his biography could not be done without an organic connection to his social roots, that I had to deal with almost every significant event in our national life, beginning with Sandberg's own birth and his parents' participation in the great wave of immigration to this country.
Yeah, you might have called the book Carl Sandburg and His Times.
Might have.
But Sandberg's, as you point out, his involvement in the major events of his lifetime actually put him at odds with Robert Frost, who was different.
Frost tended to focus on the poetry, and Frost expressed strong political opinions in private, in the privacy of his letters, for instance. Frost did not assume the role of spokesman for any particular political point of view, and the two poets disagreed fundamentally on the role of the poet in his relationship to public life. Sandberg, on the other hand, believed passionately that it was his duty as a poet to speak to these living issues as he described them. He tended then to applaud the work of poets such as Archibald MacLeish and Stephen Crane and others Stephen Vincent Benet and others who spoke out as he did on contemporary issues. So it was an area of divergence for the two of them.
Where does Sandberg rank? What is his stature as a man of letters?
Sandberg never quite fit any prevailing critical mode. He gradually his presence in anthologies, for example, has diminished gradually over the years. As I discussed in some detail in the book, he received in 1951 a review which I suspect summarizes the existing critical appraisal of Sandberg. This review was written by his friend William Carlos Williams in Poetry Magazine, the little magazine which had launched Sandberg in 1914. The review was written in the year that Sandberg won at last his Pulitzer Prize in poetry. He had earlier won the Pulitzer in history for the Lincoln biography. I would say that critics of every decade have generally dismissed Sandberg as a significant poet.
What did Williams say?
Williams said that Sandberg showed a pronounced lack of development. He didn't find any cohesion of voice in Sandberg. He found him lifeless. He disparaged Sandberg's what he saw as Sandberg's sentimentality. He felt there was a certain element of expediency in Sandberg's work.
What is your opinion? Will Sandberg rank as a poet for the ages?
I am not a prophet. I have no confidence at all in my prophetic abilities here. my thesis is that Sandburg, because he chose poetry and biography and fiction and folk music and journalism, because he chose so many modes of expression, is very difficult to categorize as a poet. Many of Sandburg's contemporaries devoted themselves to poetry, concentrated on poetry. Sandburg was a man of diffusion more than concentration. I think it's just very difficult to incorporate him into any critical mode, or rather into any poetic critical mode. He was a maverick. He was about so much more than poetry, which is by no means to diminish poetry. It's simply
one thing can be said, that he certainly was a man of enormous influence during his times, and at least that he's certainly going to be remembered.
Absolutely, for. And he's to this day, he's read, he's heard, he's remembered by hundreds of thousands of Americans out there in the heartland.
And loved.
And loved.
He was
and
the kind of
venerated.
Person that you. I finished the book saying, what a decent human being Carl Sandburg was.
Absolutely. He managed to achieve a personal life, a family life, which reflected the same kind of integrity in the sense of wholeness that I think we see in his work. He spoke, as he said, to and for the plain people, and they listened to him during the Depression. They listened to him during the 40s. They listened to him in the 50s, and I find them listening now. I was in Galesburg, Illinois, his hometown, not too very long ago, where we were, a number of people were celebrating this book, and I spent a day being greeted by person after person from his hometown, many of them elderly, many of them with their own very clear memories of Sandburg or his brother Mart and his sister Mary and his sister Esther, the family who stayed in Galesburg. And there was this this respect for this neighbor, Carl Sandburg, as well as this real appreciation for the work he left behind.
Well, Penelope and Evan, we ran out of time 5 minutes ago, but it's such a fascinating subject, and in your biography of Sandburg is certainly a masterful performance, and I read it. It took me a couple of days to read it, actually. it's a big one. It covers a lot of ground and extremely well done. Thank you very, very
thank
much.
Thank you.